Judge Scholin. Mr. Gunn, I understand, is in the audience or not?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. Jeffrey Schuler for the Secretary. I don't, as Mr. Gunn is expected, I don't believe that he's here at this time.
Okay, thank you. And I understand he's going to be the new General Counsel. Additionally, there are a significant number of attorneys from various field offices of the VA Office of the General Counsel, and we extend a warm welcome to all of you. We're here today in the matter, and to all visitors. We're here today in the matter of McBurney versus Shinseki, docket number 084015. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Mark McBurney for the appellant.
And who is with you?
Assisting me is my father, John McBurney, the appellant and co-counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Jeffrey Shuler for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. With me at counsel table is Brian Rebel, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your representative arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
You have it. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Combat veteran John McBurney appeals the BVA's denial of his claim for 38 U.S.C. 10132A enemy-held POW status. The primary issue presented is, do RO stipulations bind the BVA? Other issues presented are, did the BVA fail to provide adequate reasons and basis? Did the BVA fail to satisfy sua sponte prerequisites? And did the BVA commit error and abuse discretion in failing to address the issues presented to it? Turning now to the first issue, which is stipulations. Providence RO denied McBurney's enemy-held POW claim, saying he had not met comparability standards, standards that only apply to non-enemy-held claimants. Confused by this, especially since no other RO or tribunal or court had viewed the statute that way or treated POW claimants that way, McBurney submitted 88 clarifying stipulations to the Providence RO. The Providence RO agreed to 50 of those. Among these, the Providence RO stipulated three times that McBurney was detained by enemy forces. Relying on this fact, McBurney crafted his brief and his oral argument to the BVA. But instead of addressing any of the issues raised by McBurney or the RO, the BVA ruled sua sponte that McBurney was not a POW because he was not detained.
Counsel, your position is that the board is bound by VA stipulations?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
And what is the support that you have for that position?
The support that I would offer for that, Your Honor, is that to allow the BVA to cherry-pick which stipulations to enforce and which not to enforce would create administrative chaos for the court, would be against public policy, and would be against long-standing case law and common law.
So once a regional office enters into any kind of stipulations regarding a matter, then the board is bound by that?
That would be my view, Your Honor, yes.
Does that have any impact on the independence of the board?
Well, I don't think we get to I understand the question. I don't think we get to that matter, Your Honor. I think that once a stipulation is made, that quarantines an issue, preempts it, puts it aside. So that doesn't even come before the BVA. Of course, the ROs are free not to stipulate, but I would argue that once ROs stipulate, that the BVA is bound by them.
Counsel, are you familiar with this court's Anderson case decided in March of this year?
I am, Your Honor.
And how do you think that that fits in with your theory?
Well, I was applying it not to the stipulation argument, but more to the fact that the director of CNP had issued an advisory opinion saying that McBurney was detained. And I believe that under that ruling, that advisory opinion is due some deference by the BVA. The BVA paid no attention to it.
I believe that the Anderson case says that the findings made by the RO, the decision review officer, particularly in forwarding the case to the CMP director, were not binding on the board. So if an actual finding of an agency or of the regional office would not be binding on the board, what argument is there for a stipulation to be binding on the board?
Well, I think the argument in the Anderson case is that there was an obligation to at least discuss the director of CMP's findings as it applied to the case, and I believe it was remanded because there was no discussion. In the instant case, not only was there no discussion on the effect of whether deference was due to the director's findings, but also there was no mention of the advisory opinion at all by the Providence RO.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Among the 50 stipulations that the Providence RO agreed to were three specifically saying that McBurney was detained. McBurney relied on this fact in crafting his brief and his oral argument, but instead of ruling on the issues presented, the BVA ruled that McBurney was not detained, completely disregarding, without explanation, those three detainment stipulations. Now, the Secretary's brief does not question the form or the format or the applicability of these stipulations or the power of the RO to enter these stipulations. It simply challenges them on the basis that it interferes with the BVA's status as the ultimate finder of fact. As I'd argue earlier, I believe that this court should uphold these stipulations because to do otherwise would invoke sweeping changes to the common law and case law and would unfairly penalize claimants who have relied on those stipulations to their detriment, and again would allow the BVA to cherry pick which stipulations to enforce and which not to enforce.
Counsel, are you familiar with Donovan against West?
I am not, Your Honor.
Where the court, the Federal Circuit indicated that the board reviews the substance of a prior RO's decision, and that is subsumed in the board's decision. In this instance, if you are, as I understand your argument, you are basically kind of setting aside the stipulations as not part of the evidentiary package that the board would be weighing. Is that fair?
That's essentially my view, yes, Your Honor, that once these stipulations were made, those questions were settled.
And so the board will entertain other questions that were not settled, but as I also understand your position, the board needs to then adopt the stipulations without any independent evaluation.
That would be my view, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
The only reason to dishonor stipulations are for fraud or reasons of manifest injustice, neither present here. ROs are free not to make stipulations, but it is our position that once these stipulations are made, the BVA cannot dishonor them. Turning now to the reason or basis adequacy of the BVA's ruling.
I'd like to stick with that for a second. I noticed you cite several cases in your brief to support this position. I note that none of them are in our context, but I can appreciate it's a question of first impression. But you talk about the common law, and you talk about that this would throw chaos into the system. But it seems like common law doesn't necessarily apply within the VA administrative context as it would in a trial court and then an appellate procedure, which is more what you're analogous to. So can you discuss how we should import this concept?
Well, Your Honor, I really don't want to stray into areas that would guide the court on how they should treat these matters. I would fall back on my argument that to do otherwise, to allow stipulations to be dishonored, would introduce administrative chaos. More than that, I couldn't say, Your Honor.
Thank you.
On the reasons and basis adequacy, the BVA never mentioned, let alone adequately explained, several pieces of evidence in McBurney's favor. These include 50 stipulations, including three establishing McBurney's detainment, six establishing the RO's contradictory treatment of the POW statute, and several more establishing the Providence RO's mishandling of the case. McBurney referred to these stipulations 35 times in his submissions to the BVA. The BVA addressed them exactly zero times in its ruling or in its denial for the motion for reconsideration. The BVA also never addressed the preclusive effect of stipulations and why the BVA believed it was not bound by them. The BVA also never addressed the RO's administrative decision and statement of case, both of which found McBurney was detained. And the BVA never addressed or acknowledged the director of CNP's advisory opinion, which also found McBurney was detained. Furthermore, although the BVA did address the four eyewitness buddy statements, it denigrated them by saying that the authors were not lawyers, they couldn't give expert opinions about POW status, when those affidavits were submitted as questions of fact, to resolve a question of fact, whether there was detainment or not. After all, these people witnessed the event, and they have they bring some credibility to the matter. The BVA's treatment of them as not having the legal expertise to judge POW status, I don't believe was correct. Again, in McBurney's motion for reconsideration, the BVA did not respond to the allegations raised. Those allegations included all the things I just listed and two new ones. One was objecting to the sua sponte aspect of the BVA's ruling, and the other was objecting to the new evidence aspect of the BVA's ruling and turning to dictionary definitions of detained, particularly unwise in our opinion because we had stipulations on the question of detainment. So there was no reason, in our view, to resort to dictionaries.
Counsel, isn't the board's duty to review the initial determinations of the regional office?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I would argue except for stipulated matters.
Okay.
All these documentary references and findings favorable to McBurney, most ignored, none adequately addressed, clearly violate the principles of Kaluza v. Brown, 38 U.S.C. 7104, and 38 CFR 20.1001.
Does a stipulated fact carry greater import than a finding by the RO that is favorable to and agreed to by a claimant?
I would say yes, Your Honor.
And why?
It's an agreement between the parties up front. It's done with some consideration. There's reliance probably on both parties' parts, which I think is also important. I would offer those reasons.
The stipulation from 161 to 168, these are now online, so I don't have all of them copied here, but maybe we didn't copy all of them. Does that stipulation include some kind of summary or agreement between the parties? I mean, this is a stipulation, it looks like, it's prepared by the veteran. 69 stipulations, but I don't see anything signed by the RO or any general statement that says the parties have considered all these and agree.
There is no general statement. The stipulations were submitted by appellant to the RO. The RO replied in writing. They were clearly labeled as stipulations.
And the RO replied what?
In writing.
What did he say?
Yes or no to each matter.
So no. Why do you then say this is somehow different than a favorable finding by the RO that the claimant agreed to? Isn't that what this is?
I would, if I were to argue why stipulations have more weight, I would say, again, because it was done with consideration to both parts, with some thought, and there was detrimental reliance on the stipulations in proceeding
further. Are you aware of the court statute that precludes this court from overturning facts that are favorable to an appellant?
I am, Your Honor.
Is there something similar in the board statute or in the VA general statutes?
I'm sorry, I don't understand
the
question.
Is there something similar to that in the board's jurisdiction? Is there a prohibition from the board finding facts different than were found by the RO?
I don't believe so. I would argue again that stipulations turn these matters into a completely different, put it in a completely different category.
Just because you put the word stipulation on it?
Well, I would argue not just because I put them on, but because the Providence RO, whose director and attorney was in the room when these were being discussed, answered them. They knew they were stipulations. There was no confusion. If they had a problem with them, then it was their obligation to note that problem or even to not answer the stipulations.
What if you had stipulated that the evidence you submitted, and I don't know if this is a reopening off the top of my head or not, was new and material? Could you stipulate that?
I believe there are other administrative hurdles to overcome if that's the case. But, of course, that didn't happen here.
I'd like to assume that we rule against you in your stipulation argument and move to the question of what the board did find. Can you talk to me a little bit about your there is no attempt to detain argument in your brief?
I raised the issue of attempt. Sorry, the BVA raised the issue of attempts, and they put great emphasis into the devoting several pages into whether the German soldiers on that field in 1944 were attempting to detain McBurney, whether McBurney was attempting to detain the German soldiers. My argument was that you had one unarmed American military man sent out to receive the surrender of three armed German soldiers. And once he approached the German soldiers laughed at him and said, you're not taking us prisoner, we're taking you prisoner. And it would be our position that from that moment on, McBurney was detained, quite obviously detained. They pointed their rifles at him, they fired at him.
Is there some sort of distinction that we can draw between combat and detainment? Because pointing a gun at somebody and firing at somebody would also happen in a traditional combat situation.
Of course, I would. It may just come down to a judgment matter, of course, but in the instant case, you had three armed German soldiers at point-blank range with rifles pointed at McBurney, McBurney unarmed. If McBurney was across the field, 300 yards away with a rifle, then, of course, he would not have been detained.
Would it matter what the intent of the opposing force was, which in this case was to attempt to take him prisoner as opposed to attempt to take his position or some other military goal?
I suppose their state of mind might be important, the German state of mind. I would also look at their statements, obviously, and in this case they stated that they were taking him prisoner. You might also consider the state of mind of the appellant. Did he feel detained? Was he fearful of detainment? And I think all those questions are resolved in appellant's favor in this case.
How does that differ from a unit that's totally surrounded by enemy forces and the commander of that unit sends in a message to surrender, you will be destroyed? Is that detained?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think the soldiers who are surrounded are weaponized. And they evince they're in no power disparity at that point.
Well, what if the forces are 3-1 against you? Is that a power disparity?
I can't answer it, Your Honor, except to say that in these particular situations, this particular situation where you have the appellant at point blank range with the enemy, they're armed and he's not. I don't see how you can get any more detained than that.
Even if he turned to them and said nuts and got pulled away by his friends?
Then death would have been imminent. His friends couldn't have pulled him away. He was 300 yards away.
Well, counsel, as I understand it, the veteran dove behind a tree stump, avoided being injured by a gunshot, and also avoided any kind of capture subsequently, and ultimately was reconnected with his unit.
He was informed of his detainment, and then he tried to negotiate his way out at gunpoint. And the German soldiers tired of that, so they physically grabbed him. When there was the physical assault, he broke for cover behind a tree stump, and that's when he was fired at. Once he was fired at, his patrol, several hundred yards across the field, opened fire and returned fire. There was a firefight for the rest of the day. By the end of the day, the Germans withdrew, and McBurney was rescued by his comrades.
But he was not in, quote, captivity by the enemy at that time.
Well, that's a judgment call, of course. The director of CNP found that he was detained for 1 hour, and that might have been the hour that, from the point that the Germans announced he was their prisoner until the point he dove behind the tree and the firefight ensued.
Had he been handcuffed and kept by the enemy soldiers for an hour versus what happened, would there be a difference?
Your Honor, I think that time is immaterial. You can be a POW if you're held by 1 second.
Right.
And, of course, no handcuffs were present. I'm sorry, is that responsive to your question?
So I guess the answer is it would not be a different situation.
Yes, Your Honor.
So when the veteran went to take the surrender of the German soldiers, if his intent is a factor, would they qualify as POWs when he suggested that he was there to take their surrender and would treat them well under the Geneva Convention?
Your question is, would the German soldiers be detained if
based on how the situation began, He walked up there with the intention to take their surrender and told them that, and that they were his prisoners. So at that point, would the Germans have been his prisoners?
If they evinced an intent to so surrender, yes, I would argue.
Did he evince an intent to so surrender when they told him that he was their prisoner?
I think the game was up once they turned their guns on him, yes.
So
at that point, he was a prisoner. At that point, he began negotiating for his life and his freedom.
Believing he was a prisoner?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, counsel, if I were to apply your logic to its conclusion, any time we have combat soldiers engaging the enemy on a battlefield, even if there is a brief delay or if there's a scuffle, a fight, and let's say the enemy is prevailing in terms of a hand-to-hand combat situation for a while, during that period, the veteran is held on the ground by an enemy soldier, then that veteran is a prisoner, under your logic.
Is the enemy soldier armed?
They're both hand-to-hand at this point. So the question, I think where I'm going is, it seems to me that veteran may be able to make a case for POW status.
If I understand Your Honor correctly, I would say no, because there's no power disparity. In the instant case, three armed soldiers at point-blank range versus one unarmed soldier. In your scenario, I believe we have a rough equality of power. So I'd say no.
Okay.
Turning now to the sua sponte issue, of course, the BVA ruled sua sponte on detainment. That issue was not pled or raised or argued by either party. And indeed, why would they? There were four buddy statements. There were three stipulations. There were two findings by the RO. And there was one advisory opinion by the director of CNP, all saying McBurney was detained.
Doesn't the board conduct a de novo review?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Well, then how does anything you're arguing fit within de novo review?
Well, I would say, again, that the stipulations are a separate category altogether. Once they came up, that set those issues apart.
And what about the sua sponte addressing an issue?
The board, of course, has complete power to address sua sponte issues, but they must observe prerequisite as set by this court in many different cases. They did not do that. They met none of the prerequisites in terms of notice, a waiver, seeking the claimant's waiver, remand to the RO. They did none of that.
So you're saying the statement of the case was inadequate?
No, I'm not saying the statement of the case was inadequate. I'm saying that the BVA's treatment and ruling did not address the sua sponte prerequisites before they ruled.
Which are what?
Notice, opportunity for rebuttal, claimant waiver, remand offer to RO, and or at minimum discussion of prejudicial possibilities in its ruling. They did none of that. They did none of that in spite of two instances of sua sponte actions. One was the ruling itself, and the other was resorting to dictionary definitions of detained. We had a stipulation on that. There was no need, in our opinion, for the BVA to resort to dictionary definitions of detainment. I think that's upheld under DAV versus Secretary, where there's new evidence they must first engage in those attempts, those sua sponte prerequisites.
Is that really evidence, or is that more of an interpretation of a statute?
Is the BVA's action evidence? I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Is relying on the dictionary determination of detainment or referencing it in their decision, is that new evidence, or is that a method of statutory interpretation?
I would say it's new evidence. It was new evidence in the fact that McBurney was blindsided by that. He had no opportunity to rebut, no opportunity to reasonably anticipate that the board would go that way and defend against it.
If the secretary or if the board had not relied upon a dictionary definition of detainment and instead interpreted the statute's use of the term detainment based on not using a dictionary, just stating what they believe the term, would that be new evidence?
I don't believe so.
But he would still be deprived of an opportunity to comment.
I believe, yes, that's true. Turning quickly to my last argument is whether the BVA BVA committed error and abuse of discretion in declining to answer the specific issues that were presented to it. The two issues presented were, are ROs prohibited from using 32A, and whether enemy-held POWs must prove comparability. The Providence RO agreed to six stipulations on this. Among them, they agreed that 32B was not germane, but yet they still applied 32B to this case. The BVA, confronted with a stark choice on material issues of fact and law on the record, had no comment on these issues. Appellant raised this matter with this honorable court. This honorable court instructed him to address it in this hearing. Appellant thereafter approached the Providence RO and asked them to join him in an administrative appeal, but they declined. These material questions remain outstanding. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court.
Please.
The board held that this combat decorated World War II veteran was not forcibly detained or interned by an enemy government under Section 101-32A, and thus was not a former prisoner of war. It did so because the appellant's engagement with three German soldiers in a tactical situation did not result in him being held captive by the German government in December 1944 in a manner that was contemplated by the term forcibly detained or interned. Indeed, if this tactical situation were to be a forcible detention or internment under Section 101-32A, then every American soldier who had his military movement restricted due to a tactical engagement with an enemy force would be properly termed a former POW. This is not consistent with Congress's intent to provide special benefits to former prisoners of war on the basis of the unique nature of the POW experience during captivity.
Counsel, what legislative history are you referring to?
Your Honor, there's several. First of all, just looking at the structures of Section 101-32A, it indicates that the question is simply forcibly detained or interned. This court has looked at similar situations when it dealt with benefits determinations under Section 1112, the presumptive service connection cases, where individuals have been POWs of the German government or the Japanese government during World War II for several months, in several cases for several years. In 1978, Congress asked the VA to create or to conduct a study of former prisoners of wars starting in World War II in Korea, or on both theaters in World War II, Korea and Vietnam, to understand the special health difficulties that these individuals were having 30 years after their confinement. The resulting VA study in 1980 gave a historical perspective of the special privations, the unique privations that these individuals had gone through. And it was based on that study and that was mandated by Congress that Congress then instituted Section 101-32. In the congressional hearing at the time that section was enacted, Senator Cranston, who at the time was the ranking member of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, indicated that the bill provided a definition of former prisoner of war, which includes service personnel who are held captive either in wartime, or any other individuals who had similarly been held captive in a non-war type situation.
Are you referring to Senate Report Number 9788? Or a different report?
I'm not sure if that's the report, Your Honor. What I'm specifically looking at is a floor statement at 127 Congressional Record 11422 on June 4, 1981. At that same report, five pages later, on page 11427, I believe it was a committee report, Congress emphasized that it is possible that veterans could be interned in peacetime conditions, in a comparable situation to wartime conditions. And the specific incident that they referred to was the USS Pueblo incident in 1968, in which 83 crew members of that ship had been detained by the North Korean government for approximately 11 months, I believe it was. VA's regulations, the Federal Register entries implementing 3.1Y, specifically referenced the Congress's statement about the Pueblo being a basis for an understanding of what those types of comparable circumstances they saw in a non-war type situation that they would like to have included within this definition.
So do you agree with the appellant that 3.1Y is overly broad application of 101-32?
I think that 3.1Y actually kind of parrots the statute in a certain way. It goes beyond that. You're right, Your Honor. That first section right after Y, before the enumerated paragraphs, pretty much parrots the statute, both 101.32A as well as the first clause of 101.32B. Where the statute goes on under B, under the foreign government situation, to indicate that it's they want to extend those benefits to those under circumstances comparable, VA then has its section 3.1Y2. At that point, where we get into the enumerated paragraphs, the regulation departs a little bit from the structure of how the statute works. Here we have the board didn't based it solely upon 3.132A, which parrots up with that first section of 3.1. The board specifically said we're looking at this only under the statute but not under the regulation. The regulation, though, in this area is reiterative as opposed to interpretive. And so I don't think we get to those circumstances, those separate circumstances in a foreign situation, Your Honor. The congressional intent here, I think, is to, while it differs from captive to captive, the POW experience often includes bare subsistence, poor if any medical care, forced labor, at times torture and war crimes, and a profound psychological sense of loss. It is this context that must be kept in mind, informed by a concern about the welfare of those who have been held captive during wartime, and by a concern about those like the Pueblo, where they have been held during peacetime. Here the board applied Section 101.32A, specifically that term forcibly detained or interned, as an assertion of POW status involving an enemy government in a manner consistent with the meaning of the statute.
Now that statute doesn't have any sort of time limit for how long someone must be detained.
No, Your Honor, it doesn't.
So the question here is merely, or is specifically detainment or not detainment?
It's yes, Your Honor. It's specifically whether forcibly detained or interned or not forcibly detained or interned.
So what in Mr. McBurney's situation would have to be different to have him qualify in the Secretary's view?
I think the key distinction is that as the Secretary sees it, as the board looked at it, there's a point at which board phrases as a negotiation over status. There's a point at which we're not quite sure what happened based on the evidence that was before the board at the time, which was the testimony and some statements that were entered into. But at the point at which force was applied, based on the evidence that we have in the record, at that point in which physically the veteran stated in his hearing testimony he was grabbed, recognized a weapon was being pointed at them at that moment. It's at that moment that he resisted, that he said, I'm not giving in to this. And then we have the subsequent scenario of him ducking behind a tree and a firefight ensuing. That's the critical moment, the board saw and as the Secretary sees it, that it's at that moment when force was applied to have him forcibly detained or interned that had that been different, we would have a different scenario.
So let's just assume that Mr. McBurney had not resisted at that particular moment and he was starting to be led away, and 5 feet later he resisted. Would that have made a difference?
I think based on the lack of any time limit, it potentially could. That it's the resistance at the moment that he recognized that force was being applied to him to detain him as a prisoner. Because there is no time limit, the Secretary really can't stand here and say that there is a particular...
I want to go back to some earlier questions dealing with 3.1Y and see if I heard you correctly. As I understand it, if the decision is based on the Service Department finding that you're a POW, you're under Y1.
Yes, Your Honor.
We do not have a decision by the service department finding that there's a POW status in this case, do we?
No, Your Honor, we don't.
All right. Now, do you agree that then we're under Y2, or did I misunderstand you before? Or because Y2 doesn't have a time period, but if you look at it, it talks about circumstances, which implicitly would include some kind of concepts along that, physical hardships or abuse, psychological hardships or abuse, malnutrition, unsanitary conditions, that might take into consideration the example that Judge Sholin has just given you and say that even though detained for 5 minutes does not reach this level as is in the regulation. Now, what is the Secretary's position? Are they repudiating their own regulation?
No, Your Honor, but I am recognizing where the board based its decision. And I'm also recognizing that the statute doesn't quite track exactly the structure that the statute provides. I think there's an opening here because of that different structure where this court might have an interpretive a different type of case would bring in some different interpretive questions that might bring in 3.1Y2. But here, because the decision is on the enemy government, the statute, which is the guiding principles here, clearly indicates that where it's an enemy government, the question is simply forcibly detained or interned. Under the statute, the circumstances of that detention only comes into play.
Where Why shouldn't the Secretary be bound by stipulations that he enters into?
The structure of
Can the Secretary appeal to the board?
No, Your Honor. No.
Who can appeal to the board? Only the veteran.
Only the veteran, Your Honor.
So the veteran has this agreement with the Secretary on all these stipulations, goes up to the board. And I'll put it into two contexts. One, why shouldn't he be bound by him? And number two, why isn't he blindsided when the decision comes out totally different, when the arguments are on stipulations and something different comes out? Why isn't that a due process issue?
Well, the statement of the case, which provides the notice of what the appellate, the relevant statutes, regulations, what the agency found.
In the context of a regional office decision that agreed to numerous stipulations, that agreed to detention, et cetera. Okay. Just want to keep it in context.
If we were in a situation in which this court were to endorse the idea that the RO, once it made a decision, made a decision in which there are several elements, say, in the as there were here, whether he was detained and whether there was comparable circumstances, once they appeal, the board then has the responsibility to de novo look at all questions of law. In fact, under the statutory scheme that creates the VA.
Agreed, but what notice did the claimant have in this case that the board was going down a completely different track? In other words, is it a situation where the board accepted the argument by the appellant, didn't like it, and went off on something different? Certainly that's what the appellant is sitting here thinking.
Once he issued a notice of disagreement with the rating decision, though, we had a statement of the case that indicated how the agency at the lower level approached this, but also fully what the statute and regulations said and what the standard were. Because the board has a responsibility to de novo look at all questions of law and fact under its jurisdiction, because the final decision on appeal is made by the secretary by statute. And as this court indicated in Anderson, there's no restriction on the board's ability to look at findings before
the
agency.
Board at any time before it rendered its decision notify the claimant that they were not going to accept the stipulations of fact?
No, I don't think, Your Honor, that they did, nor do I think that there was a requirement that they do so. Once an individual appeals from the RO to the board, the questions are open.
Aren't the consequences of that unacceptable?
No, Your Honor.
The secretary, a representative, a cabinet member of the United States stipulates facts, and then the board, which we accept that they can reject them, doesn't mention anything before they render a decision?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because Congress has said under Section 511A and under 7104A that the board has the responsibility for the secretary to make all decisions on all questions of law and fact. If it was the opposite, the secretary would be violating.
But isn't there due process involved in that too? In other words, accept the fact that the board can render the decision, accept the fact that the board could reject these stipulations, accept all of that. Shouldn't there have been some kind of preliminary notice that we're not going to accept these stipulations?
Your Honor, the secretary doesn't know of any specific requirement that would mandate that process to go through, as opposed to what Anderson what this court in Anderson looked at a few months ago, that under 5511A and under 7104A, the board is the final, ultimate finder of fact.
So the stipulations are meaningless?
The regional office decision.
Right.
Any communications between the appellant and which have in this case been termed as stipulations, they are not binding on the board, which looks at all questions de novo. And that has a consistent basis, I believe, in the Secretary believes in making sure that veterans, when they come before the agency, have two bites at the apple, one at the RO and one at the board, on all questions, and that final agency action is a combat unit that then is appealable to this court. There's a broader system to this than just question of stipulations and whether the agency would.
I believe the appellant is arguing that there actually weren't two bites at the apple because he didn't believe that the issues that he stipulated were going to be on appeal. So he didn't present any arguments as to that particular set of questions.
Well, the appellant was on notice through the statement of the case, which is the proper way of notifying appellants of what's coming up on appeal, what the board will be able to look at.
Where did the statement of the case say that stipulations you entered into in good faith with the Secretary will not be adhered to?
Well, it didn't say that, Your Honor.
I believe the board member said that he would be looking at the entire record and questions de novo. Would that, if there is some sort of requirement, would something like that satisfy that?
I think, Your Honor, that certainly provides some indication of that. I believe the appellant at the time that happened indicated, yes, I understand that you'll be looking at everything de novo. The Secretary is not aware of any specific requirement that the Secretary back up and stop its look at all questions of law and fact under these two statutes and somehow preclude itself from going into other areas.
So you distinguish this from a Bernard type of scenario?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about what do you think is the appropriate standard of review for this court in this case?
Well, this court in Manabon looked at this situation applied. I believe this is the only other case that's discussed 10132 within the context of an enemy government. The ultimate, there's a legal conclusion as to whether somebody's a former POW, but the question of forcibly detained or interned, that court then said was a factual determination based on the Secretary's unique role in understanding the factual basis here. And in its application, the Secretary's view is that the proper standard is a clearly erroneous standard of review on the factual question of whether he's forcibly detained or interned. And then in this case, the board had a plausible basis for concluding so.
Is there a legal question involved in what the board decided in how to define detained?
I think, Your Honor, that question of what is the definition of forcibly detained or interned is a statutory interpretation question, which this court looks at de novo. It's the application of that then to the circumstances here that the Secretary feels is properly done as a clearly erroneous standard, as Manabon indicated.
Thank you.
So if we were to find a due process issue associated with the stipulations not being accepted and not giving claimant notice beforehand that they wouldn't be accepted, if we were to find anything with that. Is it your view that we could review this from a legal standpoint as to whether or not he was legally detained under the statute, which is the way the board went, that he was not detained, except the facts found by the board that he was not detained?
Well,
as a matter of law.
The premise, of course, we disagree with the premise that...
I understand that.
But if the court were to say the board had no power to go into that and to say, to question what the RO's approach, that would seem to be then preclusive, that the board would not be able to say that he was not detained. There would not be a question.
Well, you still have a question, it seems to me, unless there's a stipulation definition of detained, as to whether the detained met the statutory requirement for detained.
Well, yes, Your Honor. our view, yes, Your Honor, but in our view, looking at the question of forcibly detained or interned as essentially being held captive, that the board would have to look at that question as they did here and see a...
I mean, if the board had gone through and said, we understand the stipulations, we understand the regional office entered into these particular stipulations, but for purposes of the statute here, we don't believe it rises to the level of the statutory detention required, and went on through its explanation, you then would have addressed the stipulations.
I guess
not. Another issue aside from due process, it's a reasons and basis issue, but it would have been addressed.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, yes, you're right, that had they specifically said in their decision that there was a there are these stipulations out there, they're consistent with the regional office's action, their official administrative decision, but we're going to go a different way. But I don't think that would be any different, though, as than the scenario we have in which the administrative
decision... They impliedly did that.
I guess impliedly, yes. I mean, I don't necessarily see the lack of specific references in the board's decision to the back and forth questioning between the appellant and the regional office's official as particularly critical. The critical function, it would seem to me, is the administrative decision and what they found in the administrative decision. That's what was appealed.
And if it was a matter of law, would there be any reason to remand to the board for the claimant to make an argument before the board as opposed to here, since questions of law are reviewed de novo by the court?
I guess I don't think so. I think in the end, the same outcome is here, that his particular circumstances didn't indicate that at the moment that when force was applied, that he was that he accepted that, that he resisted it, and therefore wasn't forcibly detained. I think the board's conclusion there is a sound one and based on a plausible basis in that record. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. McBurney, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief. I only have 3 points to make. The first point is that there were 50 stipulations. They were on the record. The BVA was advised of them 35 separate times by the appellant in his documents, and the BVA addressed the stipulations issues 0 times, never mentioned it once in its ruling or in its denial of McBurney's motion for reconsideration. I think that's an obvious reasons and basis.
But if we were to accept all the facts with regard to the timing, with regard to the approaching without a weapon, with regard to the jumping into the bushes and so forth, et cetera, if we accepted all those facts and then determined as a matter of law that it didn't reach the level of detention, what would be the reason to remand to the board? You're making your arguments right here, and we do the de novo review on issues of law.
Assuming all that, we still have the sua sponte aspect, the procedural due process implications.
Which what? You're making your argument now, aren't you?
I'm making several arguments, Your Honor.
Well, with regard to the question of law, whether or not the facts found by the board reach the level of detention under this statute, if we were to determine that that's a question of law based on the facts we have, there's no reason to remand to the board, is it? Because we do de novo review.
I can see the point, Your Honor.
Okay.
My next point is that it's perhaps of interest to the board to know that the RO also stipulated to the fact that comparability does not apply to this case. It was the RO's opinion that comparability only applies to 32B cases and not 32A cases. Despite that fact, they still ruled that McBurney failed because he didn't prove comparability, even though they acknowledged that he was seized and detained by enemy forces.
But that you agree would be an issue and a problem with the regional office decision?
Yes, Your Honor, a problem not addressed by the BVA. My last point, I think, is a definitional issue. I think that perhaps the Secretary and I have different views on what constitutes detained. My emphasis has been on the power disparity, and I think the Secretary's emphasis has been on resistance. I would argue that many POWs resist for their entire 5-year internment in camps. I would argue that that's not an unusual situation. I think the key, perhaps, is to look at this
not only in terms of power disparity, but was appellant free to leave, with three German soldiers weaponized at point-blank range. If he had turned and walked away, what would have been the outcome? The outcome almost surely would have been death. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to give you an opportunity to respond to the question I posed to the Secretary, which is, I believe at the board hearing, the board member mentioned in response to you raising that there were stipulations in the record that he would have to review everything de novo. And does that constitute notice to you that they were going to be looking at everything?
In my mind, no, Your Honor, because I put stipulations in a separate category. In my mind, I believe that stipulations, once agreed to, that preserves and quarantines an issue, and it can't be touched on appeal. That's the way it's treated in federal court, and I had imagined that it would be the same in this court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case will be submitted. We'll come to brief counsel.
All right. This honorable court is adjourned until further notice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for hearing this. I don't
Do you have 2 minutes to guide me through the